This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Iraq and Afghanistan. For women in those two countries, the contrast is simple. Unlike Afghanistan, with its years of Taliban repression, Iraqi society maintained a notable level of sexual parity. In both countries, U.S.-led regime change means a reevaluation of women's roles. As Iraq crafts its future, women wonder what role they will play in the new government, and they wonder about the growing influence of conservative Islamic clerics. In Afghanistan, a year after the fall of the Taliban, some women are beginning to lose the rights they so recently regained. If you have questions about the current conditions and the future position of women in Iraq and Afghanistan, give us a phone call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. How do societies balance tradition with modern ideas about equality? If you're from a country where the position of women has changed dramatically, we'd be very interested to hear about your experience. Again, the phone number is 800-989-TALK. We're going to start our conversation in Iraq, and our first guest, Rend Rahim Franke, is Executive Director of the Iraq Foundation, an organization that promotes democratization in Iraq, and she joins us from her office here in Washington. Thanks very much for being with us on Talk of the Nation.
My pleasure, Neil.
Remind us a bit of an historical lesson. What was the situation for women under the Ba'athist government of Saddam Hussein?
I think you mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan in the same breath, and it's important to note that the condition of women in Iraq was very, very different from what it was in Afghanistan. Historically, and I would say for the past 50 years, Iraqi women have been a very big component of the professional life of Iraq. They have been lawyers, doctors, professors, pharmacologists, and so on and so forth. So they have contributed professionally, and there was a great deal of freedom for women to choose a profession and acceptance of women in the professions in Iraq.
In the professions, but in government?
No. And I was going to come to that. In government, it was slightly different. There were indeed women in government. There was the occasional minister, for example, in Iraq. Certainly at lower levels, at mid-levels of government, there were lots of women. There weren't very many women in the upper levels of government. They were not appointed. It was not regarded as something normal and natural for women to attain high ranks in government, whether neither in any legislative councils or in any executive councils.
At the same time, though, we should note that certainly the availability of professional ranks for women in Iraq distinguished that country from just about anywhere else in the Middle East.
Correct. And I think the closest parallel I can think of in the Arab world is Egypt. It was very comparable to Egypt in that respect, and a very far cry from countries like Saudi Arabia or other Gulf states. But the other thing to note is that women were not involved in the political process per se in Iraq. In other words, when they were given jobs in government, these jobs were bestowed by men. They were not because women were so much part of the political process that they could campaign, they could organize, and they could obtain positions in government on their own steam.
Now, last month you were able to attend the first planning meetings in Nasiriyah and Baghdad to talk about the future government of Iraq. Is there a role for women envisioned in that?
Well, not as far as those meetings were concerned. In Nasiriyah, there were about 70 to 80 Iraqis, only three of whom were women. We complained a great deal about this, all three of us, and made resounding speeches about the importance of women's participation. In Baghdad, there were 300 delegates, and still only the same three women. We were extremely disappointed in this turnout. And again, we complained that we spoke against this at the meeting and afterwards. And I'm trying to do my best now to increase the number of women who are going to participate in the forthcoming meeting, which we hope will be held at the end of May. It's imperative for women to participate, because what we do not want to see is a regression in the status of women in a new Iraq. After all, we are building a democratic Iraq. We're reconstructing for the future. What we don't want to do is to turn around and see that the status of women is far worse under a new non-Ba'ath, non-Saddam Iraq than it was in previous eras.
I'm curious, in the situation in Afghanistan, and again, the situation for women in those two countries was very different, but in the situation in Afghanistan, where President Bush spoke about the liberation of women there as one of the great benefits, there was a great deal of emphasis on ensuring that women were put into roles, that there was a Ministry of Women's Affairs, that sort of thing. Has there been any mention of that this time around in Iraq?
You know, there has been quiet support. We certainly haven't heard the president or any senior official speak publicly about the subject, perhaps because in Afghanistan the situation was so much more dire. There was a great need for affirmative action in that, for example, girls were not allowed to go to schools, girls could not walk out on the streets on their own, nor can women, and so on and so forth in Afghanistan. So I think it was such a stark deprivation that we saw in the situation of women in a way that doesn't really exist in Iraq. So perhaps the administration feels it's not such a crying need, but I can assure you it is, because what women want to see is, just as the entire country wants to see progress to more democracy, more participation, really, more pluralism, so that participation has to be seen by women in the role of women in the new Iraq. And I think that Iraqis will be at great fault if they do not recognize this need. And I think the administration of President Bush ought to stress it, because while it's not so dramatic as it was in Afghanistan, we simply cannot be seen turning the clock back on the gains of women.
The Al-Hawza al-Ilmiya Shiite movement has set up a shadow government in the city of Najaf, where they are calling for Islamic reforms and requiring women to wear veils. Are you worried about a possible rise in Islamic fundamentalism and how that might affect women's rights?
Well, you know, first of all, we should remember that in 1990 and after 1991, the regime of Saddam Hussein began to clothe itself in an Islamist garb, or in a Muslim garb, I shouldn't say Islamist, including, as everybody knows, right, the writing of Allahu Akbar on the flag. But the 1990s actually witnessed a clampdown and a restriction by the government on women's freedoms and rights in Iraq. So in 1990, we began to see a greater restriction on women in Iraq done in the name of religiosity. Now, this is a very dangerous thing. And it would be a big setback if the mullahs and so on should impose much greater restrictions on women in Iraq than existed, say, pre-1990 or even after 1990. I'm not saying this is necessarily going to happen, and Islamic movements are going to be a part of a political process. The question is whether they're going to be the exclusive arbiters of what goes on inside Iraq socially and politically, or whether they are going to be part, just another voice in a broader participatory effort. There's no question that we do not want to see the kind of restrictions that were imposed in Iran on women imposed in Iraq again.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Rand Rahim Franke is a executive director of the Iraq Foundation, and she was with us from her offices here in Washington, D.C. And joining us now from our bureau in New York is Isabel Coleman, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, director of their initiative on women and U.S. foreign policy. And good of you to be with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm sure you were listening to what Rand Rahim Franke was talking about as in our discussion just a moment ago. What do you think needs to be done as arrangements for the creation of an Iraqi government go ahead?
I think that it is important, as Rand was commenting, that women need to be part of the political process there. And there are, like, including Rand and several others, very active women in the Iraqi exile community, who I know are taking an important role in the reconstruction of Iraq and in that political process. And I think it's extremely important that their voices are heard in the U.S. government, and that while there has not been, as she referred to it, an affirmative action program to the same respect that there has been in Afghanistan for women, I think it's very, very important that the U.S. government keeps it high on their radar screen, the role of women the gains that they had made under the last 20, 30 years in Iraq, and that they don't see any slippage backwards.
Do we know what Iraqi women want?
I think Iraqi women, I can't speak for them. I'm not an Iraqi woman. Mm-hmm. But I think that they probably want very different things. I think that there are some who want, like Iraqi men, there's some who want a secular state, a modern country. They want political and economic opportunities. There are others who want to feel comfortable that whatever state they have can coexist comfortably with their religion and their beliefs and their customs and traditions. And I think you'll see it all across the map. There are going to be women who choose to wear the veil, who feel more comfortable being more modest. There are others who want a more liberated experience and will interpret their religious obligations differently. And I think they want the freedom to be able to choose.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address TOTN@NPR.org. And let's begin with Michael, who joins us on the line from San Diego.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air, Michael.
I'm from San Diego.
That's what it says in front of me, but
okay. I want to compare what happens in these countries with respect to what has happened in our country here.
Mm-hmm.
We became independent in 1776, right?
Correct.
But the ladies, women, could not get to vote till 1920. How do you explain that? We've been waiting for so long, and we expect others to do today, if not yesterday, suddenly change. And one more point. Hello?
Yes?
We don't even have the equal pay for women in this country.
Well,
we don't even have a president elected as a woman. Take Pakistan, which is a Muslim country, which had a Muslim prime minister. Bangladesh, a Muslim prime minister, a woman in both the countries. And take Indonesia, the biggest, the number one Islamic country. They have the president as a lady. So how do we say the incongruity between we are propagating something but we are not practicing? Even the democracy, I think at this rate, it can be termed only as a democracy. I think we are making a mockery of democracy. So we have to set an example before we ask someone else to do. How about making the pay for the women as equal to men today before telling them? Please comment on this. I'm not putting us down, but I want to say that when you want to set an example, we have to be an example.
Isabel Coleman?
Yeah, you raised some good points. I mean, there is... Rend was commenting earlier that women in Iraq didn't have tremendous political opportunities, but they did constitute, I think, 20% of the parliament. Yes, those positions were bestowed upon them by men, but 20% is more than the 14% that women have in the United States. I think, though, that we are comparing apples and oranges. I think that most women in the United States feel that they have tremendous opportunities today available to them. You're right to point out that it took years to achieve that and that there's clearly room for improvement. We could talk at length, no doubt, about glass ceilings in politics and in the boardroom.
And have.
But I think that women here feel that they do have a lot of personal freedoms and economic and political opportunities. And I think while we're not trying to impose necessarily our own culture or beliefs on Iraq, that we would like to see, I think that Washington would like to see a regime there that allows women to participate in the economy, in the political fabric of the country, in the civil society.
We're talking about the future of Iraqi women in government and society. When we come back from the break, we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Here on Talk of the Nation, we're talking about women in Iraq and Afghanistan and how the recent regime changes in those two countries will affect their position in society. Our guest is Isabel Coleman, the director of the Women and Foreign Policy Initiative at the Council on Foreign Relations. And, of course, you're invited to join our discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And Let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Gail, who's with us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Well, hello, Neil. I'm so glad to be on the show with you.
Oh, it's nice to have you as well.
I think you're doing a great job, and I really enjoy Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
I'm calling to talk about my own personal experience. I was brought up in a conservative Jewish home where the thought of touching or holding the Torah, our holy book, was completely alien to me. It was nothing that I would have ever approached as something I wanted to do or something that was actually appropriate to do, because it was not in our culture. Years later, as a young woman, I had the opportunity to touch, hold, cradle in my arms the Torah. At first, I didn't want to do it because it seemed like so wrong. It seemed wrong. But then encouragement from the Reform rabbi, I did it. I picked up the holiest of our holy books, and I experienced just a marvelous connection to my religion and my ethnicity and my people. It was very emotional, and I think that something that is easily forgotten when we talk about regime change and culture shock is that people are emotional creatures. It's not always an easy thing. We approach these sort of changes. We approach the taboos that we had abided by for so many years, now as freedoms, with mixed emotions. It's sort of like, well, it was wrong in the past. Is it all right now? And it's not going to be an easy thing, I think, for Iraqi women. Some of them have probably spent their whole entire life trying to get out of the burqa and play soccer, you know. But for many of them, I think that they will be torn. And if anything, that sort of emotional ambivalence sort of paves the way for fanatic groups to regain control or clear things up in their minds for people by saying, you know, return to the fundamental style and you'll be much more comfortable. Comfortable, if not free, but, you know, in a place where there's not so much concern that you're going against Allah or disgracing yourself or your religion.
Well, that's a fascinating story, Gail. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, any comments that other people might have on that, I would be very happy to hear.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And Isabel Coleman, Gail does remind us that this is an emotional experience and different for women from all different kinds of walks of life.
That is true. I think that you'll see women reacting across the country very differently to the current changes, the very rapid changes that are going on inside Iraq. I think that there is no doubt a return to fundamentals and conservative values that occur in times of turmoil and change. And you may see women becoming more religious. But on the other hand, I think many Iraqi women have enjoyed a lot of secular freedoms over the past several generations. And I don't think, in fact, the majority have been wearing a burqa. In fact, you look at the pictures, and there are many Iraqi women wear all different forms of dress, depending on where they are in the country, what their religion, religious beliefs are. So I think that you'll find a lot of different reactions across the country. And the challenge in Iraq will be developing a political process that can allow people to express their opinions and achieve their desires through the political process in a peaceful way.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mo, who joins us from Kingston, North Carolina.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Neil, for taking my call.
Sure.
I just like to make quick comments about, you know, about religion and women in general. Islamic religion in Iraq or in Afghanistan, if we go back again to this religion, we must know that in the Islamic religion, Prophet Muhammad used to work for a woman. So in terms of giving the woman a great participation in economically and politically is really in the Islamic religion. So we really have also to explain this in terms of that religion, because if we explain this politically, I think there will be misunderstanding about our motivation and so forth.
Yet in some of the cultures that embrace Islam, this is not always interpreted that way.
Well, that's the problem, because if we look at the Islamic religion this way, I think this is what it is. I mean, nobody can deny that Muhammad, the prophet, was or used to work for his wife in terms of trade, and his marriage to her, and also afterwards as well.
The
thing is, we should really focus in democracy and also give the environment that will allow women and men to be participating in the democratic process. And we should really not focus on how they should be dressing and all these kind of things. But I think the most important is to focus on the core and the value of democracy and what the benefits they will be getting from democracy. Women everywhere, I think, generally, they really suffer from different regimes in the Islamic world and not Islamic world as well.
Okay, Mo, your phone is cutting out. I think we have your point, but thank you very much for the call.
Okay, thanks.
Appreciate it. Isabel Coleman, obviously he was talking about the importance of democracy, and I think we're not going to argue about that. But I wanted to ask you, is Western-style equality across the board, is that the goal in Iraq, do you think?
No, I don't think that is. I think that... and I'm not even sure what Western-style equality means. It differs across Western countries, and I'm not even sure, harking back to an earlier conversation, that there is even true equality within the United States. I think what we'll hope to see in Iraq is that the gains that women have made there are secured, and that they have the opportunity to participate in the economy, in the political process, in the political system, in civil society, in ways that they wish to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the points that we should talk about is education, and the fact that men and women, or boys and girls, over the past 10 years in particular under the sanction regime have suffered from a lack of education. 25% of school-aged children have not even been in school in the last several years. And girls in particular have missed out on education. There's a significant gender gap in Iraq in literacy rates between boys and girls and men and women. And I think that if you want to have a democratic society, which will take time to develop there, that you really do need to focus on educating the population. And I would put a particular emphasis on making sure that the girls receive a good education in that country.
We want to now expand our conversation to include Afghanistan, the other Islamic country that has experienced U.S.-led regime change in the past couple of years. Joining us now is Zema Korsun-Neffa, co-author of a recent report on the status of women in Afghanistan for Human Rights Watch, along with Isabel Coleman. She joins us from our bureau in New York. It's good of you to be with us.
Thank you, Neil.
Can you tell us what you're hearing from women in Afghanistan about, I know there have been reports that in some places at least, the liberation that some women felt with the fall of the Taliban has been reversed.
That's right. There really is no peacetime for most women in Afghanistan. Even though the Taliban has been ousted and the U.S. government is saying that the war is basically over, outside of Kabul, the situation is very dangerous for many women. You know, I was just in Afghanistan in March, and there are many women for whom it is virtually too dangerous for them to leave their homes. And all of these theoretical freedoms that they expected to have with the ouster of the Taliban simply haven't been realized.
The place that we read about is the city of Herat in western Afghanistan.
That's right. In December, we issued a report on Herat in western Afghanistan, which is a province in the west that is run by the governor Ismail Khan, who is a warlord. He is former Mujahideen who fought against the Taliban and was a U.S. ally. Now, he's brought most of western Afghanistan under his control and brought a relative degree of security so that women in Herat City say that they can walk outside during the day fairly safely. But at the same time, he's re-implementing a whole series of Taliban-era edicts that are putting great restraints on women's basic freedoms, freedoms that women in Herat expected that they would regain after the Taliban left.
Mm-hmm. Security, though, you have to start with that. Without that, there is nothing.
Absolutely. The number one thing that women in Afghanistan need today is security. And in many places of Afghanistan, especially the southeast where I've just returned from, women simply don't have that. And without security, they can't take advantage of any of their basic human rights.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to a caller. Paul joins us from Jackson, Wyoming.
Hi there, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Listen, I'd like to just make a comment about the fact that the Bush administration had used women's rights and the suffering of women in Afghanistan as sort of a some kind of an additional reason for going in there, and it should come to most as no surprise that that sort of got dropped along the way, given the fact that the neoconservative agenda that the Bush administration is trying to push is going to try to abandon women's rights in this country. Why should people be surprised that they're not going to follow through in Afghanistan? I'll take the comment off the air.
Okay, Paul, thanks
very
much.
Great program.
Appreciate it. Zaman Khorsanneff, do you think that this has been dropped?
I think that women's rights haven't been given the weight that they need to continue to be given. And things like education, which is critically important, has been used as a bit of a fig leaf to avoid looking at some of the important other issues for women in Afghanistan. Now, it's true that a lot of girls have gone back to school. This year, about 1.2 million girls are back in school. But there are a whole lot of other girls who aren't back in school, either because they don't have schools or because it's too dangerous for them to travel to go to them. We also need to be thinking about women's participation in government. There's very low participation of women, even in the Kabul government, whether or not women have access to jobs, whether they have equal access to higher education, whether they're able to organize and criticize their government. In a place like Herat, where women have tried to do that, have tried to form organizations, have tried to write newspaper articles critical of the government, they have been crushed.
We're speaking with Zaman Khorsanneff of the Human Rights Watch and Isabel Coleman of the Council on Foreign Relations about the situations of women in Iraq and Afghanistan after the conflicts there. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call. Poonam joins us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. My comment is that we in the West, promoting women's education and freedom of choice in Islamic countries, should be very careful about not playing into the hands of the Islamic leaders, because historically in Egypt, as well as in India and other cultures where there's a large Muslim population, the Muslims and their leaders have made the argument that they put women under restrictions that do not give them the freedom of choices, precisely because they may be corrupted by Western values of democracy and free choice. So right now it's a very critical moment, because Saddam Hussein himself has made the case that Western values and America should be resisted. It seems that the mullahs will be making the same argument. So we should make a distinction between what role women have played and the argument about women and education within Islam historically, rather than to intervene as though we were a disinterested party.
Mm-hmm. Isabel Coleman, get a response from you?
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point. And while the U.S. government has not come out directly and said this, I have heard people in the State Department certainly comment on the fact that they will not tolerate a religious administration in Iraq. They will not tolerate a...
I believe that was Secretary Rumsfeld who said that, yes.
Well, yes, and the State Department has also indicated that while they're walking a fine line, they don't want to meddle and be seen as meddling, but of course, meddle is what they've done. I mean, they are trying to rebuild a country and trying to make it seem as if they're doing it with a light touch, but I think it's far from it.
May I make a follow-up comment?
Very quickly, if you would.
Yes, I want to say that there are different strands of thought within the Islamic world, especially on the very long history of the debate about women in education. So the thing, in my mind, the smart thing to do would be to let those discourses or those voices surface rather than to impose from here what we think should happen.
It's again, a good point you make, and there are many different strains within the Iraqi Muslim population. In the Shia South, there are some very conservative fundamentalist Shias, and there are also Shias who seek a secular country and have a long secular tradition and want a separation of religion and politics. I think that while it's fine to say that we should let the Iraqi people decide for themselves, it will be a messy process and a long process. We're seeing it in Afghanistan right now. There's the writing of a new constitution. It's been going on for almost a year. The new constitution was just handed to President Karzai a couple of weeks ago now, and there's a process to get that approved by a loya jirga. Mm-hmm. Over the course of the next year, you're going to see a same constitutional writing process in Iraq over the next several years. And I think while you want the Iraqi people to be taking a lead on that, I think the only point I was making earlier is that there are some powerful interests within the U.S. government who want to see it go in a certain direction. They don't want another Iran.
And if I can just make one point,
you'll get the last 30 seconds, okay?
The most important thing to learn from Afghanistan is who are the Iraqi people you're putting in power. In Afghanistan, we've put the warlords in power. We shouldn't do the same thing in Iraq.
Thank you very much to you both. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Zeyma Korsun-Neff is a researcher in the Children's Rights Division of Human Rights Watch, co-author of their report on the situation of women in Afghanistan. There will be more coming out as investigations there continue. Also, Isabel Coleman directs the Initiative on Women and Foreign Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations. They were both with us from our bureau in New York. When we come back from a break, we're going to be talking about a unique mother-daughter story in the week running up to Mother's Day. I hope you can stay with us. If you'd like to join in, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.